Hello and welcome to DNA Today. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. DNA Today informs you on what is happening in the genetic world, shows packed with news stories and lessons, all to keep you updated and educated on the ever-changing world of genetics, and you found me on my new time, 11:30 a.m., still on Mondays. Don't forget to tune in every week at this time, 11:30 Mondays, for all things genetics. So our first news story is about researchers identifying a genetic mutation accountable for metabolic disease among Inuits in northern Canada. So we're going to talk about what this disease is and why it possibly is more so in this population of the Inuits in Canada rather than just North America. So this metabolic disease is called glycogen storage disease type 3A, and it's caused by mutations in the AGL gene. Now, this mutation is correlated with a less active glycogen debranching enzymes, and this disorder affects the body's ability to release sugar from glycogen molecules. So the body's having trouble extracting this sugar from glycogen molecules, which kind of makes it hard to use sugar. Symptoms of glycogen storage disease type 3A include hypoglycemia, enlarged liver, and muscle weakness. Now, how prevalent is this glycogen storage disease type 3A? Well, it affects around 1 in 100,000 people in North America. Now, compare this to 1 in 25,000 in Quebec in the population of the Inuit. And so this is a big, big, you know, gap. We have 1 in 100,000 people in North America and only 1 in 25,000 people in Quebec. Now, researchers estimate that the level of glycogen storage disease type 3A prevalence within this population is among the highest in the world, which is obviously great then to be studying that because it's very active. This disease is very active and prevalent in this community compared to the general population, especially in North America, as this research is kind of taking both populations and comparing them. Now, scientists looked at this difference and designed a study in attempts to answer the question of why the disease is more prevalent in the population of Inuit people. What is the genetic difference in particular between the general population of North America and the population of the Inuit people in Quebec, Canada? Now, writers of the study said, quote, "The aim of our present study was to identify the genetic cause of glycogen storage disease type 3A in the Inuit population in Navanque on the eastern coast of the Hudson Bay." And they published this in the Canadian Medical Association Journal. Now, the study conducted research on 5 Inuit kids who were affected by glycogen storage disease type 3A, and they had standard DNA sequencing methods were used on these kids, and then 2 of the kids also had whole exome DNA sequencing done. So we have all the kids having the standard DNA sequencing methods, while some of them are having whole exome DNA sequencing. So the kids who had the whole exome sequencing done, their results revealed a mutation in the AGL gene, which I kind of previewed before. Now, further testing with standard DNA sequencing confirmed that each of the 5 kids had the mutation. So this original testing that had, but kind of looking at more information from this whole exome DNA sequencing, identified this gene, and then the standard DNA sequencing methods were able to kind of check that the other kids had this mutation as well. And they started out, all of these kids had the mutation because, well, they had the disease. So they're taking kids that they knew had the disease to then identify the gene. So now they are linking this mutation to the disease. We don't really want to use the word cause because, you know, nothing can really quite be proven in science. So we like using terms like linked and things like that you can say there's an association between things, but it's not necessarily a causation. Now, kids experience symptoms of the disease like an enlarged liver and hypoglycemia, which I mentioned before. And hypoglycemia is a condition that occurs when your blood sugar, glucose, is too low, which makes sense because the body is not able to extract the sugar from the glycogen molecules. That's what this disease is. And the mutation that is associated with this disease now that they've linked is AGL gene. So to further explore this disease, researchers discovered that the family members of the kids with the disease were carriers for the mutation. Now, this information points to the founder effect. I don't know if you remember this from, you know, bio back in high school or maybe college. Now, the founder effect is the loss of genetic variation that occurs when a new population is established by a very small number of individuals from a larger population. So if you think about this, if you have a couple individuals and that start this new population, whatever genes they have, that's kind of how the population is starting. That's, you know, how it's being founded, founder effect. So if we have, say we have 10 people starting this population, I don't know if that's realistic, but let's go with it. So we have 10 people starting this population. If 3 or 4 have the mutation, there's a good chance that a lot of their offspring are going to have that mutation. Now, say if you had 100 people starting the population, only 4 or 5 had the mutation, then that mutation is not going to be as prevalent in the population. And Dr. Celia Rod comments on this study saying, quote, the discovery will help interested families and communities receive genetic counseling and screening to help identify and manage the disease. She goes on to say, earlier diagnosis may help prevent hypoglycemia and organ damage in infants and serious health complications. This is something that I'm going to be talking about later in the show, if I have time, we'll see. And really talking about the importance of genetic counseling and screening and education on that these services are available to people, but also that when you go through these services, you can get educated and you can make decisions based on the information that we know. So Dr. Jane Evans of the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, Canada, explained how vital it is to take advantage of this modern technology in genetic research. Quote, although an appreciation of such variation in disease frequency and population genetics principles have been around for some time, the application of modern methods for gene identification now has the potential to improve outcomes for patients, their families, and communities. So really stressing that point that it's so important to have this message get out to the general public. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do here as an undergrad, but I'm still, you know, having that effort of having people understand that these are an option to people. And that if you don't understand what your doctor is talking about, that's what genetic counselors are for, to break down that language for you, to map it all out. And sometimes they really do. They will, you know, draw a little map for you to be like, all right, well, here's your options and kind of flow chart. So there's so many great services for people to go to and really take advantage of to understand what's happening in their own genetics, as much as we can, at least. Dr. Evans goes on to say, once a causative mutation is discovered, opportunities exist to use molecular rather than more invasive diagnostic testing to start treatment earlier and to offer carrier testing to family members at risk. Now, something important about knowing if you're a carrier is maybe deciding if you will have children or not, depending on, say, you know, you and your partner are both carriers for a very serious disease, say Huntington's disease, and you really don't want to take that risk of passing that on to your children. You may adopt, you may look at other reproductive technologies to help eliminate the possibility of your child having Huntington's. So there's so many options that people don't really know about yet, and it's really important to look at testing to then even start treatment, because if you're tested early, sometimes you can really, really improve your health by having this treatment earlier on in your life. And wanted to remind you, you're listening to DNA Today, talking about all things genetics, and here's the next news story. So new research has provided new insight into the Fragile X syndrome. So I kind of want to go over what the Fragile X syndrome is and then explain what this new insight is, because a lot of people may have heard about Fragile X syndrome, but I kind of want to talk about what, who it affects, what the symptoms are, how many people it affects, all the general questions we like answering on that. So according to Genetic Home Reference, Fragile X syndrome is a genetic condition that causes a range of developmental problems, including learning disabilities and cognitive impairment. So usually males are more severely affected by this disorder than females, and I'll kind of be reiterating that a lot throughout this. The website fragilex.org has a lot of information on this disorder, including symptoms, and it goes way beyond that. So if you're interested in learning more after this show or even now, you can kind of follow along with the points I'll be saying on the website. You can go to fragilex.org. So let's explore these symptoms and how they differ between males and females. So let's kind of start off with males. The majority of males with Fragile X syndrome demonstrate significant intellectual disability. And disabilities in Fragile X syndrome include a range from moderate learning disabilities to more severe intellectual disabilities. So it really is a range. And along with a range, there's a range of physical features that may include long ears, long face, soft skin, large testicles in males. Connective tissue problems may include ear infections, flat feet, high arched palate, double jointed fingers, and hyperflexible joints. Behavior characteristics can include ADD, ADHD, autism, and autistic behaviors, social anxiety, hand biting and or flapping, poor eye contact, sensory disorders, and an increased risk for aggression. That's quite a list. Now, no individual will have all the features of Fragile X syndrome. So that's something to keep in mind is when I'm talking about all these symptoms, that doesn't mean that an individual is going to have everything I'm talking about. It's kind of a list of symptoms that people may have having this disease. Now, some features such as long face are more common after puberty. That, you know, more during childhood, not so apparent, but after puberty, a lot of things become a little bit more prominent. Now, let's switch over to the symptoms of females. So, although females don't have it as much, they also have a milder presentation of the syndrome's behavior and physical features. Males tend to have more severe symptoms, and females tend to have less severe symptoms. And about one-third of females with Fragile X syndrome have significant intellectual disability, and others may have moderate or mild learning disabilities. Now, emotional mental health issues, general anxiety, and or social anxiety are also on that list. A small percentage of females who have the full mutation of the FMR1 gene, which I'll get into later, that's a little preview, that causes FX, will have no apparent signs of the condition, so intellectual, behavioral, or physical. So these females are often identified only after another family member has been diagnosed. It may not be apparent that they actually have Fragile X syndrome. So having Fragile X syndrome does not mean a person cannot be independent. I really want to stress this because a lot of people are fully functioning person in society, and it really depends on the severity of their symptoms. So what exactly is it? What genetically is Fragile X syndrome? Because I'm talking about the symptoms, I'm talking about how people are affected, but what's happening on the molecular level? Well, it's a mutation in the FMR1 gene, and I mentioned this before in terms of affecting girls and how some are not affected by the mutation while others are. So mutations in the FMR1 gene cause Fragile X syndrome. So if there is a mutation in this gene, it can cause Fragile X syndrome. Now, the FMR1 gene provides instructions for making a protein called Fragile X mental retardation 1 protein, or FMRP protein. So this protein helps regulate the production of other proteins and plays a role in the development of synapses, which are specialized connections between nerve cells. Remember when you're learning about the nervous system, learning about synaptic gaps and the synapses between neurons of them communicating? So they're really important for relaying nerve impulses. So if you're trying to move, whatever, you're thinking about it, and that message gets sent to whatever body part you're kind of trying to move. So how does one inherit Fragile X syndrome? Well, it's inherited in an X-linked dominant pattern. So what does this mean? A condition is considered X-linked if the mutated gene that causes the disorder is located on the X chromosome. So girls have two X chromosomes, and guys have an X chromosome and a Y chromosome. So one of the two sex chromosomes we're talking about, these are the sex chromosomes dependent. These chromosomes identify if you were going to be a male or female. Now, the inheritance is dominant if one copy of the altered gene in each cell is sufficient to cause condition. X-linked dominant means that in females who have two X chromosomes, a mutation in one of the two copies of a gene in each cell is sufficient to cause the disorder. So only having one copy is saying that it is sufficient to cause a disorder. You don't necessarily need to. Now, in males who have only one X chromosome, a mutation in the only copy of a gene in a cell causes the disorder. So in most cases, males experience more severe symptoms of the disorder than females, probably due to this kind of balance because females have two X chromosomes and males only have one. So they kind of got one shot there on having a healthy X chromosome or not. So how prevalent is Fragile X syndrome? Well, it occurs in approximately 1 in 5,000 males, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC for short, as we all know it. And there's about 1 in 8,000 females. So again, more males are affected, and they tend to experience symptoms a little bit more severely than females. All right, now that I kind of blew through what Fragile X syndrome is, let's delve into what new research has now revealed relating to Fragile X syndrome just within this past week. So typical people affected by this disorder have a mutation that affects the FMR1 gene in multiple places. So one individual had only one single error, though. So usually when you have Fragile X syndrome, there within your mutation, there's a lot of things that are kind of not normal, or I guess you could say wrong in the gene, errors. But this individual only had one single error. So this is kind of like gold for scientists to observe symptoms and everything, because they can identify, all right, within this mutation, only this error will cause or be correlated with certain symptoms. And the individual only had two primary symptoms. So scientists were able to pinpoint which part of the gene is related to which symptoms more accurately. Quote, this individual case has allowed us to separate two independent functions of Fragile X protein in the brain. This is co-senior author, Professor Vitaly A. Kakalko, Associate Professor of Cell Biology and Physiology at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. And he goes on to say that, quote, by finding mutation, even in just one patient, and linking it to a particular set of traits, we have identified a distinct function that this gene is responsible for and is likely impaired in all people with Fragile X. So really, the ability to pinpoint that, all right, this error is correlated to this symptom is amazing, because we have more information on specifically how the mutation is broken down. And then possibly in the future, we could have genetic testing for Fragile X, people that are affected by Fragile X syndrome, and say, all right, let's look at your mutation. Let's see which errors you have. All right, so you're going to have these symptoms, and then maybe even be able to treat those specific errors in the mutation. So this new research was published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences by scientists at Washington University and Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta, Georgia. And researchers were able to inspect genetic sequencing data for more than 900 males with intellectual disabilities, but not Fragile X syndrome. So they're kind of comparing the two groups. Their goal was to identify mutations in the FMR1 gene that impaired FMRP, which is the protein, again, that the gene produces. But they're looking at mutations in that gene that did not fully eradicate the protein that's produced from it. So only one patient was found from the sample that had an abnormal FMRP, the protein again. That's the one that I'm referring to, that I was referring to before. And it was caused by a small mutation in the FMR1 gene's DNA code. Again, that's that ATCG language, that the DNA toxin. And the individual's intellectual ability was compromised and they had seizures. But the other main symptoms of Fragile X syndrome or autism was not apparent. And Professor Clacleo says, quote, the patient presents a case of partial Fragile X syndrome associated with mutated rather than absent FMRP. So just to add on to that, the protein that's being produced sometimes is just missing if this gene is not properly producing the protein because it's just not producing it. But other times the protein is just a little bit different, a little bit mutated than what would naturally be produced in someone that was healthy. So this gene can really either not produce the protein, produce it mutated, or produce it healthy. Those are kind of the three options. And obviously the mutated can be quite a range of what the protein is going to look like. It's not like, oh, it's going to be mutated this way every time. It can really differ, which you can kind of figure out from having all kinds of different kinds of symptoms. The professor goes on to say, quote, as far as I know, this is the only known case of this. It is a unique opportunity to parse this of our functions of FMRP. What does this mutation impair to cause only two symptoms of Fragile X? So that's kind of the question that they're looking at to answer this. And researchers took this new data to the mice, as they always do, almost always. They replicated the mutation in mouse brain cells, and the cells interacted normally. So fruit flies were also used to further the study, as they often are. And they found that the mutation led to an increase in the number of transmitters in the brain cells. And this is problematic as it could result in too many signals being sent with the brain. Kind of it gets a little loud and crazy in there if you have too many signals going on. So research with the Fragile X syndrome has been centered on the timing of the signals in the brain. Not only just how many are going on, but really the timing of, all right, is this kind of a normal, healthy time of, are they sending this at the right time? And they're also looking closely at receivers allowing too much information in and being too sensitive. So previously research into Fragile X syndrome has focused on problems occurring with how and when signals are received in the brain, particularly looking at receivers that are overly sensitive and allow too much information. So now with this new information on how Fragile X gene works and affect proteins in the research is switching over. Drugs that have been tested as a treatment for Fragile X syndrome could end up being ineffective due to targeting receivers in the brain and not addressing higher levels of signal transmission. It's important to note that the professor's team were able to verify the effect observed in fruit flies and mammals and connect it to human disease. That's really key in research that we're able to use these organisms and say, all right, this is how this gene is affecting them, or really anything that you're doing to them. This is how it's affecting them. All right, so what does that mean for humans? How are humans going to be affected by this? And the professor goes on to say the mechanism that researchers have long thought were entirely the problem with Fragile X are obviously still very much in play, that the research that has been done before is still useful. It's not like we're going to throw any of that out. It's good to keep in mind. He goes on to say, but this unique case has allowed us to see that something else is going on. There's kind of another level that we've gotten to with this research of Fragile X syndrome because of this one individual, you know? So it really, really makes a huge difference on that. So thanks for listening to DNA Today, where I talk all things genetics. And now, quickly before the show ends, I want to shed some light on National Birth Defect Month, because that is January, and I want to squeeze it in for my last episode in January here. So I want to go through quickly what a birth defect is. It sounds just like it is. It's conditions that affect newborns, defects that they have, and it can be on one part of their body or all parts. It's quite a range, and some are easy to diagnose while others kind of remain a mystery to us and we're not sure for years. And testing can be done to confirm that some types of birth defects, and some can be identified just by looking at someone, like cleft palate. You can see right away that's what they have. And I'll throw some stats at you. Every year in the U.S., around 120,000 babies are born with birth defects. And if you do the math, that's one every 4.5 minutes. And I was surprised to learn that birth defects affect 1 in 33 babies born in the U.S. and are cause of 1 in 5 infant deaths during the first year of life. So I was really surprised on the 1 in 3 babies born are affected by birth defects. And March of Dimes is an awesome organization that helps moms have full-term pregnancies and healthy babies. So if something goes wrong, they offer information and comfort to the families. And they research problems that threaten babies and work on preventing them. And March of Dimes has revealed that birth defects-related hospital costs in the U.S. exceeded $2.6 billion, with a B, billion, showing it's not only a medical issue, but also a financial issue. And I kind of want to go through the top 10 most common birth defects in the U.S. And this was published by the CDC. And I'll just go through the top five here. So the first one is Down syndrome. That's, that one wasn't too surprising. That's over 6,000 cases a year. Cleft lip, that means with or without a cleft palate. That has a little over 4,000 cases a year. And cleft palate without a cleft lip is 2,600 cases a year. The fourth one is atrioventricular septal defect, and that means they have a hole in their heart. That's just shy of 2,000. The fifth one is an absence of malformation of the rectum and or large intestine, and that's, again, just shy of 2,000. So there's quite a lot. You can Google to look at the rest of them. I'll put the link in the show notes for you. So obviously birth defects is a major problem, but there are ways to prevent it, and that's kind of the point of January being National Birth Defect Month. It's really looking at putting awareness to this and looking at prevention. So Liesl Beers, the president of the National Birth Defects Prevention Network, shared a quote saying, although not all birth defects can be prevented, there are steps women can take to increase the chances of having a baby born without birth defects. She goes on to say, small steps like visiting a healthcare provider regularly and consuming 400 micrograms of folic acid daily before and during pregnancy can go a long way. So Liesl Beers is really right on about taking folic acid. If pregnant women took 400 micrograms of folic acid each day during the initial stages of pregnancy, up to 70% of neural tube defects could be prevented. 70%. So that is so key and so important. And I've mentioned genetic counseling probably almost every episode at this point, and sometimes multiple times, like on this show. But genetic counseling can be a really important part for preparing for a healthy pregnancy or even after you get pregnant. Geneticists can help people to learn more about genetic conditions and find out what the likelihood would be of their child being born with a genetic birth defect. Now, not all birth defects are genetic. Some are environmental. But for the genetic birth defects, there are screenings for genetic conditions ahead of time. And it may seem obvious, but to avoid harmful substances is another really good prevention method. These substances are alcohol, cigarettes, and they can, along with others, and they can have huge impact on the development of the fetus. And again, according to March of Dimes, smoking during pregnancy causes 20% of oral clefts. So that's lips and palates. Another somewhat obvious one is having a healthy diet. Following a healthy diet is crucial to achieving and maintaining a healthy weight. And any changes in diet need to be long-term rather than viewed as a quick fix. That's kind of common sense, but good to mention. A diet rich in fruits, vegetables, whole grains, low-fat dairy, lean proteins, and healthy fats and oils is recommended. And that's about all I have for today. Went through a lot of information. That's DNA Today you just listened to. And you can tune in next week, Monday at 11:30 a.m. I have switched from 1 p.m. on Mondays to a little bit earlier in the day, 11:30 a.m. You can listen on whus.org or 91.7 FM to learn more about genetics. So definitely tune in 11:30 a.m. And don't listen to the 1 o'clock because that's not me. But you can listen if you, I think it switches to music at 1 o'clock. Used to be public affairs, but hey, we're switching it up around here. So if you want to learn more about genetics on the web, you can visit dnapodcast.com. You can follow on Twitter at dnapodcast. Follow me on Twitter if you're interested in what I have to say at kiradineen. I'm Kira Dineen. Emails. I love them. So send in your questions, comments. If you want me to talk about something on the show, if you want to even be interviewed, if you have relevance in genetics, I would love to talk to you. So that's info@dnapodcast.com. Thanks for listening and join me next week, again, Monday, 11:30 a.m., to learn more and discover new advances in the world of genetics.